Here on We Gotta Talk, we cover a range of issues from the serious all the way to the superficial. Like you, my interests are really all over the spectrum. I care about what's happening around the world just as much as I care about if that new retinol cream actually does get rid of my fine lines. And when it comes to the more serious issues, I know this. It's easy to just turtle away when you live in America, let's be honest. Despite the raging political polarization, you can still duck most of the real problems that are out there. And that's why I think it's more important than ever to stay informed. The motto I came up with when I started We Gotta Talk is Real Talk, Big Topics. And today we're going in hard on one of the biggest of big topics there is, at least as it relates to politics. It's all about American interventionism. Put simply, do we need to keep out of the rest of the world's business? I wanted to cover this issue in light of the 2-year anniversary of the start of the Russia-Ukraine war, which I also covered on my podcast when it started. I asked you on Instagram, does America need to mind its own business, or are there conflicts that are worth intervening in to preserve and promote democracy? And if so, how does that look? Today, my expert and I dive into that question as it relates to both Ukraine and Russia, as well as the Middle East. We're going to make it simple for you to get the basics on what's happening and help you form your own opinion about what's best, if anything, to do next. My guest today is foreign affairs expert and Fulbright scholar Calvin Dark. I hope this interview helps illuminate some of your own thoughts about a couple of big topics that are happening in the world right now. Enjoy. Calvin, as I mentioned a little while back on Instagram, I asked the blanket question of if American interventionism is a good or bad thing and why. So most people started saying off bad, you know, I did a little question box thing. And then as I was continuing to turn the question over in my typical fashion, I was reaching out to friends who had different life experiences. So I talked with a friend of mine who grew up in communist Poland. And I can, you can imagine what her thought was as it relates to Russia and Ukraine. And then I shared that and started to see the responses turn. So is there ever a simple answer to the question, is American interventionism a good or a bad thing?
Well, you know, I think there are two parts to that answer, okay? The first one is, what do you believe the role of the U.S. should be in the world just in general? Not just with conflict, but, you know, with pop culture, with our influence. And I think most Americans want the United States to be the leader. We want to be that country that not only has the culture and the democracy, but also can come to the aid of our allies. So that's one thing. The other thing is what generation you're from. And I think that's a large part of why there's kind of a disconnect between our policymakers and the American public. Our policymakers are on average a lot older, and they come from a generation where the Cold War Russia threat was just different. And I think that depending on where you came in from, your generation, colors how you view this threat or lack thereof from Russia. So I think those two things are important.
So let's talk specifically about Russia and Ukraine. We're just, I guess, past the 2-year mark when Russia first invaded. And I remember bringing on an expert back then and hearing her opinion on whether or not, how support should look for Ukraine, right? Should it look just to be in the form of money and military equipment, or should there be a boots on the ground situation? And of course, as you just mentioned, there's pros and cons to each. Obviously what happened, our troops stayed out, but as we know, we have supported Ukraine financially and through military equipment in various ways, even though it's been really old and probably ineffective military equipment to an extent. However, we made our mark, more or less. 2 years later, was it a mistake?
Well, I don't think it was a mistake. And I say this, if I tried to think about what are the different sides in the argument saying, I think that even the sides now that may have an issue with our aid to Ukraine believe that it was up to the United States to do something 2 years ago. Now, 2 years later, it kind of differs if we did exactly what we should do. And if I could just simplify kind of the argument from some, like I think Senator Tom Cotton is a good example. Republican, he has been very, very forceful about aiding Ukraine. But his issue with the Biden administration is they didn't do enough at the start. And, you know, it's kind of been the drip, drip, drip. And that's why it hasn't been effective. And something I thought about this morning as I was refreshing my memory, what it was like 2 years ago before this happened, I came across a really interesting quote from Secretary of Defense Austin, where he said on the first day what our three priorities were in this quarter. The three priorities were protect NATO, aid Ukraine, and avoid war with Russia, in that order. And I think everybody was on board with that in the beginning. Just how we got there, that's where people differ.
Why in general, and you mentioned a really important thing, which is worth noting, that there the support for American intervention sort of varies by generation. Why these days are younger voters and people sending those politicians to Washington less apt to want to take the approach that Senator Cotton did, which was, hey, let's get in there early. Let's, this is a crude way of saying it, but tinker while we can, help support democracy while we can. And that way we don't have a massive problem 2 years down the road. Why are younger voters so much less likely to support that type of plan?
Well, I think that younger voters, and I kind of want to be on the end of that group, although some may say that's a stretch. You know, 9/11, the Iraq War, Afghanistan, you have people probably in their 30s who only remember us being at war at some point in those conflicts. And I think that especially now that the world is a lot more connected through social media, a lot of young people are like, well, why are we doing it like this? Especially when we see the huge, huge price tags. You know, when we see the for example, we're struggling to solve our student loan crisis, yet there's $60 billion waiting for Ukraine. Now, it's, of course, a lot simpler than that. I mean, a lot more complicated, but that's what people are thinking. The situation also makes me think of the quote. It's always attributed to Winston Churchill, although I think there's some doubt whether or not he said it, but I think it's so true. You can depend on America to do the right thing once they've exhausted all other options. And I think that that kind of addresses the whole, well, let's kind of do it lightly, tinker around the edges, because maybe that'll work and we don't have to be in there 20 years. But we're saying now, some people are saying maybe that wasn't the best approach.
Yeah, just to bring everyone up to speed, and Calvin, this is going to be an overly sort of simplistic catch up on what's been happening there. And of course, people can go back and read as much as they want. But just as of taping, just yesterday, Russia attacked the Ukrainian city of Odessa, and Zelensky was there with the Prime Minister of Greece. I mean, these are overt attempts, even if they come out and say, which they have, it wasn't an attempt on Zelensky's life, and we would have gotten them if we wanted to. These are still acts of incredible aggression, and they show that this isn't going to moderate on its own. So does America start to take a different approach, or are we well beyond that? Because if what happens that you just mentioned, which is the problem compounds over time, it's starting to feel like more of an immediate threat.
Well, I think we're at a crossroads now. It's kind of like, you know, the whole, if you break it, you buy it. You know, I think that we're at the point where if we're going to continue helping in any way, even if it's just through continued aid, we have to acknowledge that we can't stop until the threat is finished, okay? And now if we decide to take the other route along that road and say we're going to focus more domestically, or we're not going to be in the situation, let Russia and Ukraine hash it out themselves, then we have to be completely out of it. But I think that the events we've seen this week show that if we're going to be involved, we have to be all in. And I think that is at the heart of the kind of disagreement. Notice nobody's disagreeing really about what weapons to send or how much the aid to send. No, I think we're really disagreeing on, at this crossroads, are we all in, break it if you buy it, if you break it, or are we saying that's not our affair?
I mean, and this is coming just weeks after the apparent assassination of Alexei Navalny, who was an opposition leader in Russia. I mean, it doesn't take a genius. This is why I love talking about these topics. People might think, what does it have to do with me? I mean, it has everything. These are very important sort of political, geopolitical things that are happening that could impact the rest of the world stage for years to come. And when you boil it down, you have bad guy, right? Authoritarian leader taking down opposition, any form of opposition that tries to take root and bloom in Russia, allying with another sinister force at least politically speaking, in China. And I mean, maybe I'm a nerd. I spent a lot of time obsessing over another axis of evil forming. Am I overthinking this and worrying too much that we are giving, our government is giving so much time and opportunity for these relationships to foster, relationships that could very well impact our economy, our safety, everything down the line?
No, I think that you hit the nail on the head, because this, the war in Ukraine, is not happening in a vacuum. It is in some way connected to our economic difficulties with China, as you mentioned, because we're now wondering, you know, the whole, what is it, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, something like that, where it gets a little complicated. So we're trying to figure out, you know, who's on which side. And, you know, as you were saying that, something I just wanted to kind of insert into the conversation. One of the things that I found that I was actually kind of surprised about for the last 2 years, whenever I would be out of the country or whenever I'd be talking with people who weren't American about America's role, I think most Americans would say what we have done is part of our role in being a superpower, being the police of the world, whatever you want to call it, even if some people think we shouldn't, okay? I think that's how most Americans would categorize it. But if you listen to a lot of folks, particularly in the African continent, it's not categorized that way, because Putin has been very, very savvy in behind the scenes. I guess we weren't really paying attention to our Africa policy, for example, and establishing economic ties with a lot of developing countries that weren't on our radar. And part of the message that came along with that is we got to stick together, because America is trying to take over Europe. America is trying to defeat Russia, you know? Now, I don't think many people in the United States think that, but I've been told that. And they really buy Putin's argument that he's only doing this to defend himself.
To say nothing of China's investment in Latin America, the physical infrastructure investments, and in other parts of Asia as well. I mean, again, this is the stuff that keeps me up at night. What I'm seeing from a totally layman's perspective, and this is why I encourage people to just pay attention to the headlines. Think of it as like, I don't know, Real Housewives cast. You got your bad guy, you got your good guy. I know that that's subjective, but I'd like to think, Calvin, that Americans are smart enough to recognize that a person who would take out, physically murder an opposition leader or a country, and China has its own human rights abuses and issues, they would still recognize these are not the people we want to be in power. So going back to your world's policeman thing, we get a bad rap in America because we have made some big, big mistakes. The pullout in Afghanistan, like you said, the weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East, that was, I remember that well. Vietnam was so much. But at the end of the day, am I wrong in saying someone's gonna have to be influencing the way that the world works? And wouldn't you rather it be the most flourishing democracy and not an authoritarian or communist regime?
I mean, I certainly would, and I think that most Americans would, but, you know, here's, you know, when you mentioned, you know, like, we haven't always done this right, but, you know, that we're not perfect, and, you know, it just because maybe we should have done something differently in the past doesn't mean we shouldn't be trying to do better in the future. However, one of the things that I think we need to be aware of is that our enforcement isn't always consistent, and I think that that across the world, that kind of rubs people the wrong way. Because let's take on the continent of Africa. We've had 7, depending on how you count, 8 coup d'etats over the last few years in Central Africa. And the U.S. has been kind of hands off, you know, for several reasons. One, you know, kind of taking the lead from France, I think, with some of the former colonies. But think about it. You have on the African continent, you have people saying, okay, well, America's saying they're the police force. We've been asking for the police to help us for 20 years. So maybe there's something more behind what's happening in Russia. Maybe Putin is right that they have ulterior motives. And we have to keep that in mind.
I mean, it's going to sound heinously elementary, but the thought, even as a foreigner, a person born and raised in a completely different government system, world culture, if someone's saying, well, America's trying to take over, I would be like, well, that's cool. for the most part, it's a democracy. I mean, like, it is not perfect. It is a democracy. I can understand we are in the age of conspiracy theories. I have friends who are, I don't want to say very supportive per se of Russia, but who look at this issue in a totally different way and who, if possible, see the positive parts of the world that Putin has created, or the system that Putin has created. Do I? No. But anyway, all that to say, we're in an age of conspiracy theories. It's hard for me to believe, though, that again, given the sort of number one or number two choice, that people still wouldn't understand that you got to see what mechanism is thriving best and what seems to still be working the best, at least in terms of human rights, is America. I sound like such a nationalist, but you know what I mean. Like, I guess right. I'm trying to understand from that perspective, even though we've gotten it wrong, what would it take to convince anyone that the intentions are still good? Or maybe they're not good. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think what we just have to be more mindful of when we make decisions about when and where we're going to get involved and not, making sure that we articulate those reasons. You know, I'm from North Carolina, as you can hear from my accents. I'm American, but I've also spent a lot of time abroad, and a lot of my work is dealing with either being outside of the country or looking to the outside of the country. And I think that one of the things that we have to remember is at the beginning of the Ukraine war, this is an example. There were several reporters, several news channels that really covered what was happening in Ukraine differently than they would have, say, what's happening in the Middle East or in Africa. You know, in particular, there was one incident where when you had a lot of the Ukrainian refugees who were leaving in the beginning, you know, something was said to the effect of, we've got to help them because they're like us. They look like us, you know? And that, not just because of that, but that colored our actions there. And we have to keep in mind that when we only step in Europe, or when we only step in a situation where we already have a dog in the fight, like, you know, Ukraine didn't create our tensions with Russia. It kind of undercuts our argument that we're the police. It kind of makes us say, no, we're going to pick and choose which best represents what we want. And we're just going to say we're being the police.
Yeah. We don't have unlimited resources too, though, which is the other thing. And I'm not to say that one conflict is less important than another, but it would be difficult as a leader to say, oh God, well, where do we put, we are in massive debt as a country. We're taxing people more than ever. We're taking money to do stuff that people don't agree with. So by the handful, by the fistful, and we got to figure out like what's the best way. It's not an enviable position, that's for sure.
Right, and you know, I think that is where leadership comes in. You know, Democrat or Republican, who's ever in the White House, to not only explain what we're doing and what our goal and strategy is, but how our priorities are being made. You know, like why are we choosing this and not that? I think that one of the things the Biden administration needs to do if it wants to win more support for continued aid to Ukraine is Biden, I think, has done a good job in explaining why this is important in the general macro sense, you know, our allies in Europe defending NATO. But why does it take precedence over certain issues here in the United States? I also think one of the things missing from this debate that I always have to remind myself is if we think about the $60 billion aid package that's, you know, kind of stalled in Congress right now to Ukraine, you know, we're not flying $60 billion in cash there. About two-thirds of that is worth military equipment, meaning that we give them that amount worth of military equipment that we have, and the $40 billion of that $60 we spend right back in this country, you know, factories in this country that create thousands of jobs to replenish our military stockpile. So it's not as if we're sending all of that money there. However, the amount of money we've spent to Ukraine is considerable. And I think that even those who agree that it is necessary think that we could have gotten a little bit more for our money.
So let's put a bow on Russia and Ukraine before we move on really quickly. What in Calvin's world do we do? What do we do to make this right, not only for the moment, in the sense of preserving the justice of the situation, but also to create that safer world that I think everybody wants. You're in charge for a day. Lay it out for me.
I think it's a two-step process. And I don't know if Biden is listening, but here it is. Okay. First step, what are we going to do? That crossroads. We're either going to be in or we're going to be out. Okay. Once we make that decision, the second part is, okay, we got to be all in that we can't do it drip by drip. If we're going to be in, then we have to kind of go back against what Secretary Austin said, avoid war with Russia. I think it's pretty clear Russia's not going to be giving up. So if we're going to intervene, then let's intervene. And that could require our own military. It could require more money, which is why that first part we need to really have a national conversation about. But what we don't need to do is the kind of half step. Like, I think we need to go there. Let's give it a few more $1 billion without a plan or without really being all in.
So we don't pull another Afghanistan, essentially. And I know he didn't start the problem, but he ended it. He ended it horribly.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. If you're comfortable sharing, you said in the beginning, we need to decide if we're in or not in, like, would you be all in?
I would have been all in, from the beginning. Let me tell you something funny that I said this to a friend of mine. I was making dinner the other week. I think it was after Navalny died. And one of the responses from the White House was imposing more sanctions on Russia. And I think that this spokesperson from the White House said, so that Russia really feels it. And I just remember saying, you mean there's more sanctions we could have been in?
Oh, God. Yeah.
Why didn't we do that before? Yeah. Right. Like, we've been doing sanctions. I was like, I thought the sanctions weren't working. Maybe we haven't used them all. And I was like, put them all in. Maybe that'll make them stop.
I mean, this is another really like ignorant question, but I'm going to ask it because this is the stuff that normal people think of is like, no one's been able to take out Putin either. Like, I know our CIA is like dirty and nasty. Like, they can get it done if they like, is he, and I'm not advocating for an assassination, but I'm like saying we've done some nasty shit before as a government. Is he that untouchable? Like, I don't know how long he's been in power now, but it's been a long time. And we've been unable in any way to get near him.
Well, I think, for example, one of the things that we could do is regime change. You know, America has not been shy. We didn't like a leader of the country to kind of orchestrate maybe, healthy opposition building up. But I think the problem is, in that trying to avoid war with Russia, we're kind of in this weird kind of, we don't have a direct problem with Russia. So it's kind of like, I don't disagree with my neighbor, but I'm giving guns to the neighbor on his other side to attack his house. So I think that's part of the problem. If we're going to say Putin is the problem, there are ways that are internationally valid that we could do that. We could encourage the opposition. We could openly say, Putin, it's time for you to go. But it's like, on one hand, we're saying, well, we don't want war with Russia. We want to bring down the tension while we give more weapons and guns to Ukraine. It just doesn't work.
What have the differences in the approach between the Trump administration and the Biden administration been? I mean, publicly facing, of course, we saw Trump cozying up in social situations to Putin, to the distraught of a lot of Americans, to the disappointment, I guess I should say, of a lot of Americans. How have their approaches differed? And was there one that you think works best?
You know, I'm going to tell you, that's an almost impossible question for me to answer because there's a lot about Trump's relationship and perspective on Putin that I just don't understand. Mm-hmm. And, it was one thing, when he was president, of course, it was a subject of one of the impeachments and that was always in the news. But I've thought a lot about over the last couple of months as, we've talked about Russia, does he really share Putin's worldview? Is there something nefarious? I don't know. Or maybe he's isolationist. Like, I honestly don't know Trump's policy because it's so murky. Mm-hmm. We have a whole spectrum. You have on one side, he's trying to avoid war and he's isolationist versus he's on Putin's payroll. Like, literally everything in between. And I think that is something that Trump should do now is say, okay, put the Putin stuff aside, put what you think aside. What is my strategy? I happen to think that the old Republican Party would have been kind of like what Nikki Haley was saying. Mm-hmm. Like, this is our duty. We've got to go in and help. I'm kind of thinking now, maybe Trump is like, let's make friends, not because we want to be friends with authoritarians, but having them as our friend and not really paying attention to the little things they do may be a better way for America to act. And if that is Trump's position, then I don't agree with it. And I think Biden's position is better for America. It just needs to have more teeth.
I mean, on one hand, I can see like the waited out perspective, right? Like at some point, he will be gone by death or by, I don't know if by election actually, but you know, we don't live forever. So at one point I see that from one hand, I see that approach. And then on the other hand, it just feels.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring up the waited out because I think that's Putin's strategy. I think, you know, whatever you think of Putin, he has, you know, I don't think he's crazy. I think he has a strategy. I think the reason why he is maintaining the status quo now is he knows that it's an election year and that it is impossible for a divided Congress and White House to do anything big. You know, that compiled with donor fatigue. He also knows that the United States and Europe, after a few billion dollars, that people are going to be like, where's that money going? Mm-hmm. And I think Putin's game is wait this out because they're going to get tired or they're going to get distracted.
Which is more of a case then for taking decisive action if we actually want this to end, because the psychological fatigue is real, and compound that with what's happening in the Middle East. And I feel like even Americans, although we're not on the ground and experiencing those unspeakable tragedies physically, but like we're emotionally drained too. Any good American I know is involved emotionally in what's happening in the world right now. And so I hate to say this, but what's happening in Russia and Ukraine has fallen to the wayside in American discourse because now we're focused on another hotbed area. So he's not smart to use that strategy because that the fatigue is happening very much so.
Right.
So, okay, let's just wrap this up. And then I do want to talk about what's happening in the Middle East a little bit. How do you envision things playing out if you like just peering into your crystal ball? And I know that you have had the opportunity to speak to people, not only in Washington who are involved in government in some way, but also you've had that international perspective and you understand how the world sees us. So do you have a feeling if you peer into your crystal ball about how this particular issue is, are you hearing anything through your connections to the White House, anything about how this could end up?
All right, referring to Russia, Ukraine, or the Middle East?
Russia, Ukraine. And then we'll move on to the Middle East.
I think what's going to happen, I don't think anything big or anything decisive is going to happen before November. Mm-hmm. And I think that crossroads that I mentioned, we're going to be forced into it in November. And the result of the election will be the answer to that first question. And it's simple as if Biden's reelected, we're going to be in. It's just how all in are we going to be? Mm-hmm. If Trump is elected, then I think that's going to be that first option where we're going to be like, hey, Putin, we got some stuff down here to deal with. So you and Ukraine work it out. Just try not to hurt our NATO neighbors. I think that's what's going to happen. And I don't think we're going to see that until the election.
Yeah. Like, I hate to think, it's just, it's so gross that elections interfere with like actual human lives. I just hate it. I mean, whatever. I'm waiting for a utopia. It's not going to happen, Calvin. Let's transition to your thoughts on what's happening in the Middle East right now. And let's specifically talk as it relates to the Biden administration. He's been criticized roundly by just about everyone, at first for supporting Israel and then for not supporting them enough. Then we have Kamala coming out and calling for a ceasefire. Like, and he didn't, did he know she was posting on Instagram? I don't know. The discord of it all. How are we handling as a country, in your opinion, what is happening in the Middle East right now? Rate us.
I don't think we're handling it well at all. And I think that part of the problem, you know, you mentioned Biden and very strong support for Israel. I think sometimes the very public debate we're having gets simplified into two sides that don't really exist. You know, we kind of hear like, we're either going to support Israel or we're going to leave them alone and support the Palestinians. But that I don't think that's it. I honestly think that there is a majority of Americans who want to support Israel. Israel is our ally in the region. How they are conducting this war, I think most people also agree, has been absolutely horrendous. And when you ask what I think the Biden administration, how they're doing, I think their problem is that they focused on being there for our ally, which is U.S. foreign policy, but they did not, and to this point have not, put the pressure necessary to make Israel conduct this war in a way that doesn't kill these Palestinians. I think, you know, one of the things I see on, you know, when Netanyahu does American TV, you know, like my thing is political communication, right? There's this kind of undertone of, wow, when Israel got into a bind and when we were attacked, a terrorist attack, the world kind of turned on us, you know? And my answer to that is, well, it's because from the start, you didn't differentiate between Hamas and the Palestinians. And I think that's on Netanyahu. Because I firmly believe, would there have been an anti-Semitic response group? Of course. And I don't think that represents most Americans. But I think if from the beginning, Netanyahu had made clear, this is not against the Palestinians. This is against Hamas. And this is how we are going to target Hamas without targeting the Palestinians. I think we would be in a much different place.
It's a tall order, though, militarily speaking. I mean, and I've been consuming so much content on this. I'm not an expert. But typically, this is my understanding of it. And in a war, you have two sides. Both are out in the open, right? You have soldiers fighting on a front line, even if it's remotely or like you have two clear sides and they are removed from a civilian population. I wouldn't want to be BB or anyone in charge, because how do you find the bad guys who hide amongst the civilians? I mean, that is a real factor too. And I'm not disagreeing in any way that this could have been done better. I agree wholeheartedly. And I truly mourn for the Palestinian population, but this is a war with no rules because Hamas has embedded itself. And that's gotta be tactically a really difficult situation.
You know, and I've thought a lot about that. And let me tell you too, I'm not a military expert. So now I take their word for it, Israel and the United States, that it is hard. But something someone told me in the beginning of the conflict that really helped me to see this in the right perspective. I don't think anybody expects Israel to do this, that it's going to be easy, that they can easily separate where Hamas is. But let's say, for example, there was a hospital in Israel and they had information that Hamas was hiding amongst people in that hospital, right? I think that they would find a better way to eradicate Hamas in that hospital, understanding that most people in the hospital would be Israeli. Now, you see what I'm saying? I do.
And that's still an
impossible situation.
It is.
But I think more care would have been given.
Yeah, it's so difficult. And I'm thinking particularly of the first quote unquote hospital bombing that turned out not to be a firing from Israel. It turned out to have fired from the Palestinian side. We are battling, and I hate this word, we are battling misinformation though, left and right. The problem is that by the time the real stuff has come around, the false stuff has already buried itself deep in our bones. And as humans, and as many of us are empaths, we have already had that visceral reaction. And it's forced people to just pick a side. And I can't remember the saying, by the time the truth comes around, the lie has gone around. I don't know, twice, something like that. But that's the story of this war, because Hamas is an elusive enemy. And I don't envy any leader that would be charged with defending itself or finding those terrorists in the wake of what happened on October 7th. It feels impossible.
Yeah, and I think that Netanyahu and Israel in general would have more U.S. and international support if there wasn't this indiscriminate element of it. I think that, one, we should hold Israel to a higher standard than Hamas, a terrorist organization, in how they conduct this war. But I think the problem has been from the beginning, Netanyahu has made clear their goal is to eradicate Hamas because it's a security threat. And I think that absolutely should be their goal. Mm-hmm. But I haven't heard them articulate in a credible way that they really are committed to making sure that civilians don't pay that price.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. That's all I can say.
You mentioned Vice President Harris. You know, let me tell you, you saw that, you know, the aid being dropped.
Yes.
Those pictures were absolutely gut-wrenching to see children running after boxes of food. That was just hard to see. And I don't know what children, that could have been Israeli, could have been Palestinian. I'm pretty sure they're Palestinian. But that was just sad, right? It's wild that that's what we're doing. And I say wild because it is insanely expensive. It is insanely inefficient. You know, say you're trying to solve the starvation problems that's affecting a million people and you drop 38,000 meals. I mean, that's not nothing, but 38,000. I mean, so it begs the question, you only do this when you can't do it the normal way. And why can't we do it the normal way?
Hamas, isn't it? I mean,
well, right? Well, no, the reason we can't do it the normal way is because Israel's not letting it in. And to their defense, they're not letting it in because they believe Hamas is manipulating that process. But I think a lot of the frustration from Americans with the Biden administration is that I genuinely believe when Biden says, you know, I told Netanyahu that he has to conduct this war differently. When Vice President Harris was talking, you know, in Alabama about how this was just unacceptable, I genuinely believe that they believe that. Here's the thing. There's more pressure that we can put on Israel to make that happen. You know what I mean? I know it's not easy, but I think
it's
we
not
can
easy.
More.
And I agree. And, you know, I agree to holding as high as you can of standards in wartime to a country or to a force. This is not a normal war, though. And I have seen, I mean, again, is it, what am I seeing on Instagram that's real? But I am seeing aid pass through. And I'm also seeing on my Instagram feed, Hamas driving the trucks full of aid out of it. And I am also seeing, you know, a video of, anyway, it is the algorithm we are exposed to. I just have such a hard time understanding the lack of immediate visceral response to support the victims of October 7th, though. I mean, October 8th, people were, it's like, I say this all the time. I went to school, I went to college, and there was a very high international population. I was there for 9/11, and I was, like every American, shaken in mourning. And what I heard on my campus was, you had it coming. Now, my campus experience was probably different given the student population that we had, but that doesn't feel good. And I know that as an American post 9/11, I can't imagine what the Jewish community feels like, because on October 8th, before any counteroffensive, they were being held to a standard, and they still are being held to a standard that frankly feels impossible. You're battling a shadow enemy hiding amongst civilians is the bottom line. And I keep saying this, I wouldn't want the job either, but I do have a really hard time processing the lack of empathy. And in regards to Kamala, I think I sense strife between them, and I think she's chasing the young vote on his behalf, should he remain on the ticket. I think she's wising up and saying, well, I'm hearing the young contingent say they want me to say this. She may well also believe it, but I think she's politically savvy enough to know that he's not going to do it, whether that's his own personal set of beliefs or whether he's not cogent enough to do it. And she's mopping up behind him. She's like, well, listen to me, you 18-year-olds to 34-year-olds. This is what I believe. I sense some serious discord in how they're approaching this.
I think there's, I don't know if there's discord between them. I think there's definitely discord between their messages and their actions. And here's what I mean by that. I think they genuinely do get it now that there are a lot of Americans who are not against Israel, but that who are cognizant of the fact that we've got to do something so these Palestinians don't continue to pay this price. Like when you mentioned the victims of October 7th, in my mind, I've always been like that. I get that argument, you know, when Netanyahu was saying it was, you know, like however many 9/11s, I get that. I think what makes it difficult to focus on that is when you have over 30,000
listen, this is not devaluing that loss of life. Please understand, everyone who's listening, I am feeling for that. But those numbers are also being reported by the Gaza Health Ministry, which is influenced and or run by Hamas. I think there are, that being said, I know that's not, this sounds like the people who don't believe the attacks happened on the 7th. I understand the loss of life is real, but I also understand that there's a discrepancy perhaps. But either way, at one loss of life, I look at those kids.
Right, think about it. If they doubled it.
I get it. Yeah. I just want to put that on the record, though, because especially you and I are media savvy and understand that numbers that are thrown around it's kind of important to source it. And I just want to say that is not to minimize that at all. The impact is the same, one innocent life versus 100. So I just wanted to put that in there so that it's clear that where that number is coming from. That's all. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
well, I want to address that one issue because I think there's a good way to look at it. You know how you were saying that there was this kind of on October 8th. Well, you know, let's think about maybe what you did to invite this, you know, or whatever. Yeah. Here's my perspective on that. I'll go ahead and get out of the way. Absolutely, no matter what had happened in the past, that was inexcusable on every level for Hamas to attack Israel in the way that it did, period, okay? And what a lot of people were saying when that happened, not that Israel deserved it or anything like that, but that resolving the Palestinian issue should have been a higher priority for the U.S. and Israel. Meaning that we're not saying because you haven't agreed to a two-state solution, you deserve this. No. But we're saying that, you know, maybe this is why the lack of urgency, we should have been solving this with more urgency late before. But now, moving forward, because we can't change the past, I think what we need to start thinking about is the thousands of Palestinians who have been killed, okay? And this is coming from a point of, from the Israeli point of view, whatever.
Right.
We know 100% that there is not one single Palestinian who will be there the day after that does not have a direct connection with someone who was killed.
Yeah, okay? It's awful. Yeah.
And my thing is, once we look past this war, okay, which I hope there's a ceasefire, and I hope there's one before Ramadan starts next week. When we talk about what's next, right, which is a big complicated issue, we also have to realize now that you have a group of Palestinians who are, we're going to do something to get back their trust, okay? Because imagine, and from their perspective, we don't know what these young Palestinians thought about Israel or the two-state solution or the fact that Hamas has been in power since they were born and there haven't been elections since they were born. We don't know all those dynamics, but we definitely know it is going to be really hard to have the credibility we need because of this response. And I think that is going to be a huge task for whatever happens in the future for the United States and for Israel.
Let's talk about it from the political perspective and kind of go back to Calvin's world, how you would advise, whether it's current President Biden or any incoming administration, what would your advice on what level of involvement to be? That was very inelegantly said, but you know what would you tell them to do, Calvin? That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Now, as far as whether we're going to be in or all in on this question, given one, that it's Israel, our ally, and two, because we have so many interests in the Middle East, not being a part of it is not an option. I think that now, given what has happened, what the Biden administration should be focusing on is that ceasefire. Because you got to remember, too, there are still those hostages that Hamas is holding. You know what I mean?
And Hamas is not agreeing to a ceasefire. Like, everybody wants the guns to stop firing and the bombs to stop dropping, but Hamas is not agreeing to it. What do you do?
And I think that what Biden should do is some of what Israel is doing or asking of us to do on their behalf, say like at the UN, to accomplish their goal of eradicating the threat that is next door. I think that some of those things are contributing to the lack of goodwill in the negotiations. And I'll give you an example. You know, when I think it was around 100 or so people were killed with the humanitarian convoy. And, you know, Israel was saying they were fired on, then people got killed by the trucks. I honestly don't think that those details matter for this. I think that most people would agree, whatever happened, 100 civilians who were starving died. Okay?
Right.
I think that what Biden should do is really sit down, and I think we have a solution. I mean, we're America. I often tell people when I'm outside this country, we're America. We'll figure out how to get what we want. I think we sit down with them and say, we have to come up with a way to first stop this fight, okay? Mm-hmm. And I think that actually takes precedent over the Hamas war. Not stopping it, but pausing it. Saying, one, we've got to get those hostages back. And two, we've got to have these innocent people stopping being killed. And we can't have this happening during Ramadan. Let's use that time then to then say, okay, Israel, how can you ensure your security, conduct this war without the civilian casualties that we've had? And that is a hard question. And I think there are solutions. I think the Biden administration, what they're not doing is using all the pressure that we could to force those solutions. If you get the people in the room and if you let them know this, you're not going to get this support unless we figure out how to do this. Americans are smart. We'll figure out a way.
And I worry, too, that with the upcoming election, again, the first thing on their minds is re-election. And it's not ending the brutality and ending the war and ending the unnecessary deaths and these poor hostages and their families. It feels gross to think, but I'm certain that Biden would have done that were he not worried about his approval ratings among especially young Americans. He would have been in there tinkering, but he doesn't want a photo op with Netanyahu. He doesn't want to be caught on camera. He doesn't want to be, because he's so afraid, I mean, rightfully or not rightfully, of that very vocal group of especially young Americans who thinks that any level of sympathy toward Israel is a sin. And I think that's awful. People are dying, hostages are being held, and it's because it's an election year. And would it be any different if it were 2023 or 2022, I mean, or not? Or is this just the game? It's awful.
Unfortunately, I actually think it would, if this wasn't an election year, this would have been worse for on the humanitarian side, because frankly, Biden comes from a what I'm going to call old school foreign policy perspective, where, you know, where our allyship with Israel was created. And that's his mindset. You know, I think I even read somewhere that the first real like international trip as a senator he took, you know, in the 70s was with Israel. He established that connection. I mean, look, wasn't it? He was there within like a week of this happening. Like he went there. And I remember thinking like, this is a big deal for a president to go to an active war zone where you had people parachuting in. Like you want to talk about support. Biden did that. And honestly, and this is unfortunate, I don't think that they would have been as attuned to the sensitive, to how Americans felt about the human civilian cost, had it not been for a primary coming up where in a key swing state, there are enough numbers to change that electoral calculation. Unfortunately, I think that's the problem.
Do you agree that he reads a little wishy-washy on Israel in general, though? I still can't pin him down. I mean, in the beginning, I could tell where he stood, and now I can't. Is that just my perception, or do you think that things are wavering a little?
I think he's not wavering at all. It's 100%. I honestly think Biden's dilemma now is how do I address these humanitarian concerns that are a political concern, and I genuinely believe that the humanitarian issue is a personal moral issue for Joe Biden. His challenge, though, is how do I deal with that without chipping away from my first priority, which is support for Israel? I think that is what we're seeing.
Okay. I have a live question that someone dropped in. Can I ask you it, Calvin?
Sure.
Should America address the issue of who helped and sponsored Hamas to organize this, call it out, and have consequences for those who helped? And the resounding belief here is that Iran and its regime have been sort of supporting some of the terrorist actions of Hamas, Hezbollah, and what's the other one? Anyway, should they be called out, and should there be consequences for them?
I think they should be called out, and there should be consequences. Now, the timing of that, I think, is the issue, because frankly, if that discussion does not help us break through with a ceasefire and end the immediate suffering, then let's talk about it later. But I definitely think, because you know what? When this is over, and I say this war, and we're talking about what the next day looks like. We want a two-state solution. Israel says it's not possible. Maybe we have an occupation force. We say that's not a good idea. When we have that discussion, we need to then look at all of the pieces, not so much to blame, but to be like, okay, what contributed to this? So that we don't make the same mistake in the future. And I think in that stage, everybody should be exposed to what they did, including the United States of America, because we need to understand what happened so we don't repeat the same mistakes.
I think one thing that I've had trouble reconciling from like the civilian perspective, Calvin, is that to me, and I've said this since the beginning, it's not a taking sides with Israel over Palestine. It's democracy versus terrorism. Like to me, seeing Israel as a as an oasis of democracy and otherwise, I mean, let's be honest, the Iranian regime, I mean, like, they're killing women for their hair coming. Like, we can't pretend anymore, right? Let's not pretend. The Arab Spring was a thing for a reason. Unfortunately, it didn't succeed as much as it needed to. The ignorance that especially young Americans feign when talking about what's happening in the Middle East is really astounding to me. You can support the humans on both sides of this, but also understand that there's a very real element of fighting to preserve democracy here, a democracy that doesn't just serve American interests, but serves humanity. I mean, so I'm curious what you think from the American sort of populace's response to this and what you're hearing on the ground. Is people, are they just missing that part of it, or do they just don't see it?
I think it's important to, in the region, to make the distinction between those folks in the region who are a serious threat to us and our allies, namely Iran and some other Iran-backed groups in the region, which I think represent a vast minority in the region, but it is real, okay? I mean, I also think we need to acknowledge that we have potential stronger allies in the region. And I think as they, just as we push democracy in other places in the world with our allies, we should do that with our allies in the Middle East. We have to recognize first, though, you got to build trust with somebody before you can help them improve their situation. And I think that if the United States views all of our potential and existing allies in the United States as Iran, we don't have that credibility. And I think that comes through in our actions in the Middle East. I, as someone, you know, we were talking before, I've spent the last year and a half understanding exactly how hard classical Arabic is. And I respect it so much as a language, and I've learned so much about the culture across the Middle East. But it also helped me as I spent a lot of time last year in the region. We have a lot more in common than we think. And there are so many issues of difference, but there's so many that are that bring us together. And we need to differentiate enemies, which I think is a very small part of the region, with our friends and potential friends. And if we want to talk about human rights, women rights, women's rights, democracy, our messages on that will go a lot further if our relationships with our allies in the region work.
I think we're under the mistaken impression that democracy can't thrive in those places. And people don't realize that there were, in Afghanistan, there was a time of thriving, you know, women's rights and equality in a system that worked. Maybe it wasn't American democracy to a T, but there were more pluralistic, beneficial systems in place. And we always, you know, think of it as like, oh, well, in my experience, it's always been an area rife with war and with fighting. And but you're right to bring that up, is to acknowledge the potential of that. I think the fear, though, is seeing, for example, the attempt that was made in Afghanistan. Now, I think the pullout really screwed things up even more, but we did spend 20 years and nothing really took hold too much as far as an operating government system. So what do you attribute that to? Is it we know it's not the people not being ready for it, but what is it about trying to do what exactly we've been talking about, which is promote democracy and actually make it take root, that's so difficult?
I think it comes down to credibility and credibility in our intentions. Here's the thing. We know why we went into Afghanistan. It was part of our response to 9/11. And, you know, like, you know, that's a whole other show of whether or not that was a good strategy. But let's say, for the sake of argument, I do think Afghanistan played a part in that. You know what I mean? Now, how we did it and how long we did it, that's another question. But the thing is, we can't go into a country with that mindset, with guns on our backs, and then say, we're going to help you, and you're going to be like this. So you have to build the trust first before you can show them how democracy works. And also, you have to acknowledge, too, I like what you said, that the people are ready. Just like in the United States, like, people in the region know what they want. They know what they want more than we know what they want. Mm-hmm. They understand the freedoms that they have and the freedoms that they would like to have more of. And I think acknowledging that we're not dealing with backwards countries that don't know no better. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, We are dealing with countries where if we build the relationships and the credibility, there are movements and people in that country that have a vision for their country that maybe we can help with. You know, when you mentioned like, you know, maybe the American style democracy or exactly like the US doesn't work, I think that's true. But if we come to them with credibility, we might see, for example, that there are movements and ideas about how democracy can work in their country that would help them thrive. Before we can do that, we have to have the credibility.
Sure. And how do we best build that sense of trust? We know that we can't do that, for example, with Iran at the government level, right? That's not who they are. Right. So the challenge then is, right, like, how do you show that goodwill? How do you as a country help to plant those seeds and those roots? And it comes back to like the whole topic we've been discussing today, which is interventionism and all the different ways, the various ways that we try to impact positively, hopefully, other places. What's the secret? What's the tunnel in?
Well, you know, I'm going to give a plug to one of the best things I think America ever did. That's the Fulbright program. It's part of that soft power that does exactly what you're talking about. I was a Fulbright scholar to Morocco. And for those of you not familiar with it, it's a program in the State Department where, you know, they select people to go and study issues of, you know, of their interests and concern. I went to Morocco, and my first day of class was September 10th, 2001. Okay. And I remember coming to class that Tuesday and being like, what's going on? You know, like, so being in the Muslim Arab world shaped how I saw 9/11. It also helped me because I spend half my time in Morocco. And lots of people say, do you feel completely American? I'm like, oh, the more I travel outside this country, the more American I am and feel, okay? It helps me understand how I have a role as an American to show what being American is like in other countries. So soft power things like educational exchange, be the Fulbright or others, is one way. I also think our rhetoric from our politicians, there's a religious divide where there shouldn't be, because the majority, if not all the region, with the exception of some religious minorities, are Muslim. I think we have in this country a problem with how we speak about people of different faiths. Mm-hmm. Even though we are a secular nation, our rhetoric is not affected by that. For example, we talked about the ceasefire, Ramadan coming up next week. I'm not Muslim. But I understand working in the region and having friends who are Muslim and just being aware of the fact that, you know, that's a lot of people in this world who are Muslim. If we really held that up the way we held up like Christmas or Easter, then we would be conscious of the fact that this is the holy month of Ramadan next week. Maybe that should give extra urgency to the ceasefire, but we're not at that place to have that. So I think when we change that, that builds that credibility that then we can say, okay, what can we do to help the human rights, women's rights, democracy in these countries?
So it's that soft entry. It's that acknowledgement. It's that connection way of.
Yeah. If you go in with guns, you're going to, people are going to be naturally suspicious.
Yeah, I get it. You know, oh my gosh, I could talk to you forever. I'm totally having you back on, but I would love to bring you back on and talk about the very real threat of jihadis and why that element of an otherwise beautiful religion causes the guns on the backs to go in. I mean, like, because I agree. And listen, like we always say on the show, like this is a bridge building community. This is a way to understand how other people think and how other people believe. And I think our conversation has been valuable because America gets a bad rap mostly from young Americans. But I think you hit the nail on the head when you said there's no better way to appreciate being American than to leave the country for a while. And as imperfect as it is, I know I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. My listeners are probably so tired of hearing me say this anecdote, but my grandfather came from Italy and experienced a lot of difficulties financially, prejudicially coming here. But I was close enough to his experience as an immigrant to understand why the risk. I mean, they shipped these kids over in boats one at a time. Like there were four of them. It was like a catch. The next one's coming over in 2 years. When you have proximity to an immigrant, you understand why people make the sacrifices to live in this country. It's harder to hate it. It's Because you see, I see what he left behind. I see why he had to come. I see why he fought for the country in World War II. Mm-hmm. I mean, to fight and lay your life on the line for a country you weren't even born in, because you believe so wholly in the opportunity that it gave you and your family, is a really beautiful thing. And it sounds very, very sort of kitschy to say, but I think get yourself in proximity to someone who came here for a reason.
And let me really quickly, here's my positive why I'm proud to be America today example. During the Trump years, I do TV a lot. Sometimes it's analysis, sometimes it's my opinion. And I remember this was like in the middle of the Trump years. And I forget what the subject was, but I was on a talk show doing it from this right here. I'm in downtown Washington. And I went off on Donald Trump. I even forget what it was about, but I went off. And don't you know, one of the producers from this program in an African country called me and said, "You don't understand how amazing that was that you did that." And I'm thinking, oh, he agreed with me, you know, against Donald Trump at that time. He said, "No, the fact that you're a relatively young guy sitting down the street from Donald Trump and you weren't afraid to say anything about him." And you know what I told him? I said, "And let me tell you this, there are a lot of things I don't agree with Donald Trump on, but I bet if I was able to go down there and knock on the door, he would be like, yeah, talk about it."
Yeah.
You know, I think about the fact there are few, if not, I'm not gonna say there aren't any more, but in this country, I thought about, like, that's what makes me happy to be American. That mm-hmm. I can talk about the most powerful man on the planet living down the street, then go to Whole Foods and get my food and not have to worry about it. That is amazing. And I think that's what we can share with the world.
Oh, what a perfect way to end this interview. Calvin, can I call you again to come back?
I'm from North Carolina. You can call me anytime.
I love it. I'm so proud. Can you give us a farewell in Arabic? We were connecting before we officially signed on live about our love for languages. And I was just marveling at the fact that you're fluent in French and Spanish and Arabic? What else?
French, Spanish, and North Carolina English. I think a good way to end is, one of the things I've been working on is, you know, assalamu alaikum, most people know that is the greeting, but the response is a little bit longer than alaikum salam, and so I've been trying to get it. So you say to me assalamu alaikum and I'll give you the full response.
Okay, wait, give me one word at a time.
Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
It sounds beautiful. What did you just say?
What you said, you know, peace be unto you. And then also, you know, peace and blessings be unto you as well. Of course, it's the full thing. But yeah, I love Arabic language. It's great, even with the North Carolina accent.
I love it. Calvin, you're wonderful. Thank you for taking time to
thank you for having this.
Yeah, and boiling everything down. Is there a way you want to share for people to connect with you? I don't know if you are active on social, but tell us where to connect.
Probably the easiest way, go to www.calvindark.com, because I've got all my social links there. You can hear my snarkiness on Twitter or see my food pictures on Instagram. But that's Calvin, CalvinDark.com.
Calvin, thank you again. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of We Gotta Talk. As you may have noticed, I'm starting to cover more current events and news issues on the feed. And I want to know what you think. Or is there an issue you want to hear some talk about? Reach out on Instagram. You can find me at Sunny Abata. And as always, your ratings and reviews are greatly appreciated. They keep this show going. You can do that on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. Thanks again for listening, and see you next time on We Gotta Talk.